back to chapter 13. We're now dozen before he continues with the Armageddon issue is in chapter 13, verses 7 through 9, summarizing Israel's relationship to the Messiah. And he opens up with the rejection of Messiah, a weaker sword. And a weaker sword is a symbol of death, not so much the manner of death, but emphasizes a violent death, which he did die by crucifixion. Against my shepherd, this is God's shepherd, the shepherd he's already dealt with back in chapter 11, verses 4 through 14. He says, against my shepherd emphasizes his humanity, and against the man emphasizes his humanity. This, that is my fellow. The Hebrew word for fellow emphasizes the concept of equality. So literally it reads, against the man that is mine equal, says Jehovah of hosts. Against the man, humanity, that is mine equal, says Jehovah of hosts. One of those implications of the Hebrew text of deity, of the Messiah, and a triune concept. And there's also rejection at the end of verse 7. Smite the shepherd, the sheep shall be scattered. And the first result is the dispersion of the flock. And the shepherd was smitten in the year AD 30, and the flock was scattered in the year AD 70, and further in the year 135 AD. I will turn my hand against the little ones, even innocent common people ended up suffering from that first and second Jewish revolt. It projects more to the future. Second result is death of two-thirds of the flock in verse 8. It shall come to pass in all the land, or earth, two parts thereof shall be cut off and die. Under Nazism, one-third of the world Jewish population died, but under the Antichrist, inspired by Satan, two-thirds will die. But the whole third that survives are the ones that are going to finally come to faith. So two-thirds will be killed in a matter of 3.5 years. One-third survives. And in verse 9, he focuses on the fact this whole one-third that survives will come to faith. I'll bring the third part into fire. I'll refine them as silver, so fine. I will try them as gold is tried. This will result in their salvation. They shall call on my name. I will hear them. I will say, it's my people. They shall say, Jehovah is my God. And so when the Bible talks about all Israel being saved, it means there's one third remnant living at the end of tribulation. That's the all Israel to be saved, because that's all Israel at that point of time. It'll come to faith in the final day, just before the second coming. And again, that is the prerequisite to the second coming, which now brings us to chapter 14. We pick up with the theme on the capital in your outline, the campaign of Armageddon in chapter 14, verses 1 through 5. And again in verse 1 and 2, the Gentiles against the city of Jerusalem. And in verse 1, the spoil will be divided. Behold, a day of Jehovah comes. Now you see the concept of the day of Jehovah. That's the most common biblical name for the tribulation. Our most common term today is tribulation, great tribulation, but the most common biblical term is the day of Jehovah, the day of the Lord. And that covers the whole seven-year period. But here he doesn't say the day, but behold a day, meaning a specific part of the day of Jehovah. In one specific part of the day of Jehovah, your spoil will be divided in the midst of you. And that'll be part of the attack and the fall of Jerusalem in the third stage of the campaign of Armageddon. In verse 2, he specifies something he did not specify back in chapter 12, the city will fall. He again repeats what he said back in chapter 12, verse 3, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. All the armies of all nations will come against the city. But now he tells us the results. The city shall be taken or captured. The houses rifled and ravished. With half the city going to captivity, they'll be enslaved and taken out of the city. The rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. The rest left alive to be dealt with later. But the later will end up being salvation and not destruction. And notice again the chronological sequence in verse 3, the second coming and the fight, the battle. Then shall Jehovah go forth and fight against those nations as we fought with the day of battle. The details already given somewhat early in chapter 12, there'll be some more details later in chapter 14. Notice after all the armies come against Jerusalem, it is only after that that you have the return of the Lord and you have the fighting occurring. And notice in verse 4 that you have verses 4 and 5, you have the victory ascent up upon the Mount of Olives. But the victory ascent of verse 4 follows the fighting of verse 3. Here he told us back in chapter 12, verse 7, that he will save the tents of Judah first before he rescues the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So part of the fighting of verse 3 is to rescue Judah first in accordance with chapter 12, verse 3. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives. This does not mean he descends upon the Mount of Olives. It could be either a descent or ascent. One way or the other, his feet will stand upon the Mount of Olives. But again, this follows the fighting of verse 3, and the fighting ended in the valley below, in the valley of Jehoshaphat. And one major result of his standing upon the Mount of Olives will be a major earthquake at the end of verse 4. The Mount of Olives shall be cleft, or shall be divided. In the midst thereof, towards the east and towards the west, and suddenly there's a great new valley being created. And half the mountain moves towards the north and toward the south. So it moves north and south, separating, and the valley runs east and west. And these are some of the major geographical changes that will occur in preparation for the Messianic Kingdom. And this is the earthquake that will destroy Jerusalem as we now know it. So in verse 5, the Jews will begin to flee by the valley of the new valley through these mountains. The new valley in the cleft causing the Mount of Olives to divide, to become two separate mountains. By means of this valley, they will flee all the way to Azel. Exactly where Azel is, we do not know, but it must be somewhere east of Jerusalem and east of the Mount of Olives. And he points out they'll flee just like they fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. An earthquake also mentioned back in Amos chapter 1, verse 1, Amos 1:1, a very significant earthquake in the days of Uzziah, who was a good king of Judah. And the Jews fleeing the destruction of the city will flee by means of this valley. And when the Messiah returns, he points out all the holy ones with him. The holy ones will include the angels, because the angels come back with him at the second coming. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 27, 16:27, and Matthew chapter 25, verse 31, Matthew 25, verse 31. Holy ones also include the saints, like the church saints. We shall also return with him at the second coming in Jude, verse 14. Jude 14. Now, capital F, we then read some of the results of the second coming in chapter 14, verses 6 to 11. In verses 6 and 7, there'll be some changes in the light sources. In verse 6, there'll be the removal of light. It shall come to pass in that day, in that prophetic future, there shall not be light. The bright ones shall withdraw themselves. Now this is what we call a black cat when there's no light coming to the earth from the sun, moon, or stars. And the Bible predicts five major blackouts in the last days. There'll be one before the tribulation. Number 2, 3, and 4 will be during the tribulation, but there'll be one right after the tribulation mentioned in Matthew 24, verse 29. Matthew 24, verse 29. Immediately after tribulation, he says, the light will from the sun when stars will cease to shine. That'd be the fifth blackout. That's the one he's dealing with here in chapter 14, verse 6. It turns into a very one long day in verse 7. Shall be one day which is known unto Jehovah, not day nor night. It shall come to pass that at evening time there shall be light. Because what disperses this fifth blackout, this enveloping of darkness around the world, will be the Shekinah glory light that signals the second coming. And the Shekinah glory light will be for everyone in the world to see. So with the second coming and the Shekinah glory light, it will disperse the darkness, creating a long Joshua-like day. And then we'll see what he contributes to the discussion about the millennial river in verse 8. It shall come to pass in that day, in the day of the prophetic future and the establishment of the kingdom, living waters shall go forth out of Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea, and the eastern sea is the Dead Sea, half of them towards the western sea is the Mediterranean Sea. And two other passages deal with this river, Joel chapter 3, verse 18, Joel 3, 18, but the most details come from Ezekiel 47, verses 1 through 12, 47 verses 1 through 12. And we already drew a diagram earlier of this river. I don't know if it's still here. Yep. Nope. Here it is. Again, this river we pointed out will go east, flow eastward from the temple, then move south to Levi into Jerusalem, and then they'll divide in two parts, half the Mediterranean Sea, half the Dead Sea. Is this the vision that the prophet Zechariah is dealing with? Furthermore, it specifies it won't be like a wild deed only fills with water during the rain season of the winter. In summer, winter it shall be. It won't be a wadi, which is seasonal. It'll be a river which always has water flowing through it for the whole thousand-year kingdom. Another key result in verse 9, Jehovah will be king and the one God. Jehovah shall be king over all the earth in that day. In the kingdom of the prophetic future, Jehovah shall be one, his name shall be one. Everybody will know there is only one God, everybody will know his one name, because all who enter the kingdom will come in as believers. Another result is in verse 10, topographical changes. All land shall be made like the Arabah from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. That's a mountainous area right now, will become as low as the Jordan Valley, which is the Arabah Valley. That result from the rise of the new mountain we described in detail previously, to become the highest mountain in the world. Mentioned Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2, Isaiah 2, 2, Micah chapter 4, verse 1, Micah 4, 1, Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 1, Ezekiel 40, verse 1. And because of the Jerusalem being now on this new high mountain, the new Jerusalem upon this high mountain, it will be exalted above all. She shall be lifted up, sitting on the south side of the highest mountain in the world. She shall dwell in her place, from the gate of Benjamin unto a place of the first gate, unto the corner gate. The point is that from the all of the points of the different corners of the wall become the highest city in the world because it's upon the highest mountain in the world. And then in verse 11, he deals with the safety of Jerusalem. Men shall dwell therein, it will be inhabited. There shall be no more curse, no more divine curse of any kind. Jerusalem shall dwell safely. For the first time in its long history, Jerusalem will finally be a city of security with nothing threatening it. Now, capital G then deals with the destruction of the enemy in verses 12 through 15, providing some details as to how the enemy will be destroyed. That was detailed already in chapter 12. He introduces the description in verse 12 with the introduction, "This shall be the plague wherewith Jehovah shall smite all the peoples that war against Jerusalem." This is the way the Messiah will destroy all these armies of all the nations. There'll be four specific methods. The first method in verse 12 is the method of melting. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet. Their eyes shall consume away in their sockets. Their tongue shall consume away in their mouths. And because of the uniqueness of the judgment of the second coming, they'll begin to simply melt away. Now Habakkuk 3 describes the second coming. It mentions there'll be rays coming out of his fingers, out of his hands. They'll cause massive destruction. And one of the means of causing this destruction is by means of this melting. The second method he will use is in verse 13, by civil strife. The timing, it shall come to pass in that day, the prophetic future in context of Armageddon, the great tumult from Jehovah shall be among them, causing them to panic. Because they panic, they shall lay hold everyone in the hand of his neighbor, and hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. They begin to kill each other off. And so the second method is civil strife. Civil strife. On one hand, you have different ethnic groups, and on the other hand, they're confused and begin to weld the sword in every direction, killing members of their own soldiers. The third method, in verse 14, the Jews will be energized. We will also fight at Jerusalem. Those who return from Bozra with the Messiah will now enter into the final phase of the fighting. And the wealth of all the nations will be gathered together. So in place of becoming spoil, which was the intent back in chapter 12, they'll be gathering spoil of gold, silver, apparel in great abundance. And the fourth method in verse 15 is a plague on the animals used as part of the warfare equipment. The plague will hit the horse, the mule, the camel, and the donkey. And all the animals within the camp of the enemy will suffer the same plague. When he closes his book, he closes with a short summary of the Messianic kingdom. Much of the information about the kingdom is already found in the previous prophets that spoke before him, especially the major prophets of Isaiah and Ezekiel. But it points out two things about the Messianic kingdom you would not know from the other prophets. First of all, in verses 16 through 19, there'll be the Gentile celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. In the Mosaic law, it was obligatory for Jews only, but now under kingdom law, it'll be obligatory for both Jews and Gentiles at the same time. In verse 16, it'll be obligatory for every Gentile nation to send a legation to Jerusalem for the purpose of observing the Feast of Tabernacles. Everyone has left the nations that came up against Jerusalem. Of these nations that came against Jerusalem, there'll be sheep Gentiles didn't actually participate in the war, except to destroy Babylon. But we're part of the ethnic identity of these nations, but these sheep Gentiles will be the ones that will be saved and therefore enter the Messianic kingdom. Of these sheep Gentiles, every year, from year to year, they'll have to send a legation to Jerusalem to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. And God will take seriously if they fail to do so. And in verse 17, he'll punish them with a lack of rain. It shall be that whoso of all the families of the earth shall not go up on Jerusalem to worship the king, upon them there shall be no rain. And in verse 18-19, he picks up the example of Egypt. The family of Egypt does not go up, upon them there'll be no rain. Now why pick on Egypt? Because if any nation would want to avoid observing this feast, would be Egypt, because the Feast of Tabernacles arose among the festivities that came into being because of Egypt's failure at the time of the Exodus. And maybe someday the Egyptian leaders will say, why are we sending a legation to observe the Feast of Tabernacles? What nation observes its failures? And the point is, they may decide one year not to send it, so God will send a plague upon them, a plague of no rain. They probably will not make the same mistake the next year. In verse 19, this will be the same punishment among any nation that will fail to send a legation to Jerusalem for these festivities. So one new information we find from Zechariah, not spelled out previously, is every nation will be obligated to send a legation to Jerusalem to observe the Feast of Tabernacles, and the kingdom law will be obligatory for Gentiles as well as Jews. But the second element we don't learn previously is in verses 20 and 21, the holiness of all things in the land. Because under Mosaic law, there was a contrast between the holy and the non-holy. It was used within the tabernacle temple precincts or compound that was holy. What was used outside was either profane or not holy. You would not have to avoid mixing those two. But the point of verse 20 and 21 is that within the kingdom, everything within the land of Israel will be just as holy as found within the temple compound. That includes, for example, in verse 20, the bells of the horses. Again, the timing in that day, in the prophetic future of the kingdom, shall there be upon the bells of the horses holy unto Jehovah. Now that phrase was on the law limited to the gold plate on the mitre, the head of the high priest. And on this head was the line, the holiness unto Jehovah. But now even the bells upon horses will have the same phrase, because everything is equally holy in the land, in the kingdom. Furthermore, in verse 20 and 21, every pot and pan in every Jewish mother's kitchen will be equally holy to those used inside the temple compound. The pots in Jehovah's house shall be like the bowls before the altar, yet every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holy unto Jehovah's hosts. All they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and boil therein. So everything shares equal holiness within the land. Now, the command to Israel in the days of Joshua and the judges was to eliminate, annihilate the Canaanites, which they failed to do. There's always a Canaanite element living in the land in much of Israel's history. By the end of verse 21, that will not happen in the kingdom. He points out in the prophetic future, there'll be a final extinction of any Canaanite. The timing in that day, the prophetic future of the kingdom, there shall be no more a Canaanite in the house of Jehovah of hosts. And this was the Canaanites were under a special curse of God in Genesis chapter 9, verse 25. Genesis chapter 9, verse 25. They were destined for total annihilation in Joshua chapter 3, verse 10. Joshua chapter 3, verse 10. This they failed to accomplish, but the kingdom will be accomplished. And that means the temple will never be desecrated again. The temple will never again be desecrated as previous temples have been. And with the second bit of new information about the kingdom, he closes his book. Okay, I've got some questions turned in.